this edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists on books, movies, DVDs, collectibles, pretty much anything to do with the national pastime. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Kurt Smith is perhaps the preeminent author of books about a specific segment of men who have brought enjoyment to millions of fans of the national pastime. Relatively few of them have ever pitched an inning or swung a bat on a major league diamond, but without them, the legends of Hall of Famers like Babe Ruth and Dizzy Dean and others, as well as the bench players who enjoyed one single at bat, would never get to you. Smith, a former presidential speechwriter and current senior lecturer of English at the University of Rochester, has written several books on these storytellers, including full biographies of Mel Allen and Vin Scully. His latest, Mercy, a celebration of Fenway Park's centennial, told through Red Sox radio and TV, published by Potomac, is due out at the end of May, just in time for Father's Day. Speaking with Kurt Smith is an educational experience, not just for those who want to learn more about these behind-the-scenes legends, but for those who want to know more about the craft of bringing their words, through his words, to the reading public.
Kurt Smith, welcome back to the bookshelf.
Well, Ron, it's always a pleasure and privilege to be with you, and this has become like old home folks week for me, and I'm very grateful.
As a kid, who did you follow? What team did you follow growing up?
Well, ironically enough, given my present predilection, a great fan of the Old Town team, I grew up in upstate New York where the Yankees were and sadly still are a religion. And so up until probably age 9 or 10, I was a fan of the Bronx Bombers. And in the early 60s, it was very easy to do so, given the fact that they won every year, were by far the marquee franchise in all the world, and, of course, had the greatest broadcaster, as all of us knew, doing their games, Melvin Allen Israel. So I followed the Yankees until, as I say, about 8 or 9 when I went to New England, my mother being from Worcester, 40 miles from Boston, and I went to my first game at Fenway Park. And, of course, for me, the world turned upside down at that moment and was righted and has been right ever since.
So your new book now is about the broadcasters at Fenway, the TV and radio men at Fenway, and you've also written a book about Fenway Park, so this must be a labor of love for you.
This is a very personal labor for me. You know, Dorothy Parker was asked if she had enjoyed writing, and she said, no, I enjoyed having writ, which I always thought was a wonderful delineation. But, Ron, for me, this has been a book that I have enjoyed writing and also obviously enjoy having writ. But it's very personal. Fenway Park, of course, turns 100 years old this year, the centennial. It is, I think, without question, the flagship ballpark in all of Major League Baseball. Every park really in their heart of hearts would like to be Fenway, would kill to be nearly as popular and well-known. And so I think it was a natural evolution to write a book about Fenway, especially given its stunningly successful and seamless renovation of the last 10 years. But also because I think the Red Sox have one of the great litanies, if you would, broadcasters among any big league team. And this is really three books in one. One, the story of Fenway Park, 100 years old. The second, the Red Sox, who are even older. And then finally, their voices on the air, radio with the Sox dating back to 1926 and television in 1948. And anyone who has spent even a day in New England understands how the Sox are its civic religion and how you can't go anywhere, I mean anywhere, when the Red Sox are playing and not hear them on radio and television. So this book has tried, I hope successfully, to capture at least a part of what makes the Sox the Sox.
Now, at what point did your interest shift from the players on the field to the men in the broadcast booth?
Well, I think I was always hooked on the English language. You know, Winston Churchill, not sure that he was a Red Sox fan, but may have been. Can't ask him now, sadly. But he said that words are bullets that you use as ammunition. And I've always been entranced by how baseball playmen could utilize story and anecdote and the marvelous use of the language to make the game really more riveting than it was. And that love of language later led me into another life of politics as a presidential speechwriter. And so I have been entranced, by and large, by how artists can utilize the English language. And that dates back, to Mel Allen, to Red Barber, even to Phil Rizzuto, the Scooter with the Yankees, and later with the Red Sox as well. Because, I grew up in upstate New York, as I said, and we were hundreds of miles from the nearest big league park. So we couldn't just hop a trolley and jaunt down to the nearest park to follow the game by necessity. You had to do so through the seamless tapestry, the hypnotic fabric, if you would, of baseball on the air. I was lucky. I grew up on Allen daily with the Yankees and Dizzy Dean on the CBS television game of the week, who fractured English as no one has or ever will, once saying, for example, that batter, he's standing confidentially at the plate. So the words, the rhetoric, the magic, for me, they're all in one. And I got a lot of company because I think tens of millions of people feel exactly as I do.
Now, what about you? You mentioned Dizzy Dean. Now, what about that mangling of the language? Are there current broadcasters who kind of make you cringe, or is that just part of the overall scope of the broadcasting?
It all depends. Dean did it with a panache and a flair. One never knows, and I have been unable to resolve whether what he did was accidental or deliberate. Who cares? It was magical. Today, it depends. There are broadcasters that don't utilize the English language with perfection, but they have a charm, and they keep you hooked, and that's really what counts. So I think it's like presidential rhetoric in the sense, Ron, that there's no one route, there's no one triptych, if you would, by which a broadcaster could say, if I do this, I make the major leagues. No, the key, I think, is to be a virtuoso, if you would, in whatever mode you take. Dizzy Dean, for example, and Vin Scully could not possibly be more different. Probably the two most disparate people on the face of the earth, and yet each stunningly engaging. Scully in one paragraph and one sentence really can segue from Faulkner to Carlyle to the Duke of Earl to the Duke of Snyder. That's a pretty good transition. So I think the key is to find out what works for you. And you know the old song by Bing Crosby, accentuate the positive and minimize the negative. Well, that's, I think, what any big league broadcaster does.
You mentioned Scully and you mentioned Allen, and you've written individual biographies on both of these broadcasters.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the differences in their styles. You mentioned all the culture that Scully brought. I don't remember Mel Allen doing it to that extent.
He didn't. Of course, he didn't need to. Not with that voice. Someone once said that if Mel Allen was selling fish, he would make you think that Puccini wrote the score. And I have said that a florist must have decorated his voice. Variety magazine had a poll in the 1950s of the 25 Ron most recognizable voices in the world. Not just sports, but recognizable voices in the world. Dwight Eisenhower, De Gaulle, Churchill made the list. Mel Allen was the only American broadcaster, which I think speaks volumes. So they approached the game very differently. Scully, I think, took Latin at Fordham. Is a great linguist. Will never leave a preposition at the end of a sentence. Will never invert a tense. A magnificent broadcaster, I think. As Roy Hobbs would say, if you look at the or was said of him, if you look at the longevity and continuity, Scully is the Roy Hobbs, the best broadcaster there ever was. But Allen had the greatest voice, and I think at peak, at prime in the 1950s and post-war America, he was at that time the best there ever was. Because he had a voice that Ben did not. And as Chris Schenkel once told me, he could make, Mel could make even a horse race sound like the Second Coming. So I think that particularly if you were a kid and impressed simply by drama and the majesty of the voice, there was no one like Mel Allen.
So we have Vin Scully, who's been broadcasting since the late 40s or early 50s?
1950. 63 years of doing the game in succession, and he's lost a bit, but not very much, and particularly the voice. The voice is still the same, which is the very first thing to go with many broadcasters. But, you know, you talk to people at DirecTV, and you talk to people with the Sirius radio. And, Ron, there are no studies of this, but their officials believe, and I believe them, that more people subscribe because of Vin Scully alone than all other Major League Baseball broadcasters combined. If that's not a tribute, I'm not sure what is.
Now, people have talked about every time there's a new expansion, they talk about the players who probably don't deserve to be there and they wouldn't be there under other circumstances.
Right.
But expansion has a similar effect on broadcasters. There are broadcasters out there today who may not be working back in the 50s.
Would not be working back in the 1950s. I think that's quite correct, or as Izzy Dean would say, Podna, you ain't just a woofin'. Yes, I think expansion has been a reason, Iran, for that. But there are other reasons. The great broadcasters, without exception, will tell you, including John Miller, today's great broadcaster, along with Scully, in my view, the best there is. You know, we were talking once, and he said, without exception, baseball artists, people who really do the game well, prefer radio to TV. Because you're the show. Nothing happens until you speak. But moreover, the great broadcasters, including John Miller, began on radio and then went to TV. Relatively easy to do because you develop a style, you sort of dial back, you know how to spin a story, you know how to tell a word picture, you know how to fill dead air. Well, then you go to TV and that's a snap because it's like simply easing a 78 RPM record back to 33 and a third. Too many broadcasters today begin on television, which, as Lindsay Nelson once said to me, is nothing more than picture plus caption. The broadcaster supplies the caption. He doesn't know then how to go from radio to television. And the sound that you hear is dead air. Another sound is listeners clicking off the dial. So I think that is another reason why there are broadcasters today who would not be on the air even 20 years ago. Another reason is that as a culture we've devianced and dumbed down. We don't read. Well, how can baseball be exempt from that? And so as a result, today you get broadcasters with nowhere near the vocabulary of or lexicon of a Kurt Gowdy, a Mel Allen, and certainly a Vin Scully, all of which has contributed, I think, sad to say, to a less than golden age in baseball broadcasting. I remember talking to Jack Buck, who broadcast from 1954 to 2001, and I said, is it fair to say, Jack, that this would have been probably about 1999, and we were talking about, let's say, the 1960s and 70s? And I said, is it fair to say that broadcasting now has lost a step from your heyday and broadcasting's heyday? And he said, no, that would be incorrect. It's lost about three or four. And I think that that's true, and it saddens me to say so.
So who would you name as the all-stars of the current generation?
Well, I always hesitate to do this because I'll ignore someone I don't wish to. But certainly Andy Freed, I think, of the Florida Marlins. John Miller, is the best. Today and has been for a number of years with the San Francisco Giants and formerly, it's sad to say, formerly of ESPN. I'm trying to think, Pat Hughes with the Chicago Cubs is a terrific voice, I think, and really gives the Cubs a prepotency, if you would, in Chicago, not that they need it. Joe Castiglione with the Red Sox, Dave O'Brien with the Red Sox, John Sterling with the Yankees. I say that it's Sterling time, and the arguing is easy. you love him or hate him, but one thing that you don't do is ignore him. And that's the acid test for a broadcaster. In New York, I think of the Mets and their broadcasting crew, including Mr. Cohen, who I think is one of the four or five best broadcasters in baseball and the best broadcaster, I think, in the Big Apple today. I'm sure there would be others, and they would broadcast well, and they would be successful in any era. The difference, Ron, is that you could, in the era of 16 teams or 24 teams, you could go to virtually every team in Major League Baseball and say, they have a star behind the mic. You can't do that today.
Now, speaking of stars behind the mic, could you pick up, let's say, a fan favorite in one market let's say the New York market for argument's sake, and plonk
right.
him down in Fenway and have him accepted?
Depends. I have, ever since I first wrote Voices of the Game, the hardcover back in the late 80s, made the point that baseball broadcasting, despite the Allens and the Scullies and the Harry Careys and the Dizzy Deans, who had a national following, the game is still basically regional. And, you know, in the music man, Harold Hill says, you got to know the territory. Boy, if you're a broadcaster, you'd better know the territory or you won't be there for long. Yes, that's a very good point. Harry Carey owned, justifiably, Middle America, first in St. Louis, then Chicago. To me, he was as Falstaffian a character as ever broadcast the game. I think if he were at Fenway Park, amazingly so, he would have been deported because his style would not have worked in New England. The Red Sox fan has been brought up since Fred Hoy on radio in the 20s and later Jim Britt on radio and television in the 40s, and then Kurt Gowdy, the cowboy at the mic, 15 years at Fenway Park when his Red Sox stunk up the joint, and yet radio and television ratings in the 50s and the 60s were Olympian. Why? Because of New England and because of Gowdy. He once said to me, New England is like, and this is a wonderful quote, it's like Jack Webb, Sergeant Joe Friday and the television show Dragnet, just the facts, ma'am. And that's New England. It knows the game so well. The Braves there since 1876 until they moved to Milwaukee. The Red Sox, a charter member of the American League in 1901, a civic religion, 712 straight sellouts, a major league record, ratings that every year you would kill for with another team. It's not because of the let me entertain you, but rather quite antithetical. Give me someone who appreciates why I listen, who doesn't condescend, who doesn't try to patronize, but who gives me the score, the balls and strikes, telling me what's happening, understands the game, has the verbal ability to elucidate and enlighten. That's the kind of broadcaster I want. So you're absolutely right. Jim Woods, for example, 1974 through 1978, and I write about this in my new book, Mercy, about the centennial of Fenway Park. Those 5 years, he and Ned Martin, in my view, for what it's worth, arguably the best radio tandem in the history of Major League Baseball. And yet Jim Woods had broadcast in a very different style when he was Bob Prince's partner at Pittsburgh in 1958 through 1969. He said to me once, and this is in the book, he said, if I'd done a Looney Tunes like I did in Pittsburgh with Prince, I'd have been run out in New England. So he was a wonderful broadcaster, Prince Woods was, but a very different kind of broadcaster with Prince in Pittsburgh as opposed to Martin in New England, because he knew his game and he knew the territory as well.
That's very interesting about the regional sensibilities playing into whether the fans are willing to accept the broadcaster.
I agree. This is why Scully would have owned New England, not that Gowdy didn't. Because Scully is very much, yes, he will tell you stories, he will fill dead air, but he understands the game. He played it for him, and he can express a sense of the game's poetry and awe as Gowdy could at his best. And so these are the kind of broadcasters that don't think of themselves as larger than the team. There's a part of Mercy where I talk about certain franchises that are very pleased that their broadcaster is bigger than the team. Prince was bigger than the Pirates. Carey was bigger than the Cardinals, and he was bigger than the Cubs. And I said the Red Sox are not that kind of team, and they don't have to be to really be appreciated, to be listened to, and to ultimately understand their market.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about your process. You've
yes.
been writing about baseball for many years. Your book about Dizzy Dean was published in the late 70s.
Right.
And you're constantly publishing. How have your research methods changed over the years?
Well, here's how they haven't. I have a one-man crack research staff, me. For whatever reason, I hope it's not I'm a control freak, but I simply think that, you know, my name goes on the cover. I want the book to be accurate. I want it to be forthcoming. I want it to be true. And the one person I can be sure who at least will try to assure that is me. And so I go to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. I can't tell you, Ron, the number of times I've been to Cooperstown. I can tell you that it never ceases to thrill. I mean, it really is a baseball brigadoon. And I'll bet I've been to Cooperstown since I was a kid 100 times. And it never loses its novelty. And, of course, if you're a baseball author, it has the Bart Giamatti Library, which is the greatest repository of books and magazines and other research in the world. And it is my constant companion whenever I write a book. So that hasn't changed. Also, what hasn't changed is that it's, whether a presidential speech or a magazine article or a book, I write every word longhand on a yellow legal pad. And I have since the first book. I do today. I don't recommend it to other people, but it seems to work for me. I think that writing is so individual and so personal that step one in becoming a writer is you have to find out what works for you. I think this works for me. And so by the time I transfer or segue my hopefully legible first draft on a yellow legal pad to a computer, that then becomes my second draft. And what has changed, of course, as you know, and every listener of yours knows, the computer has revolutionized not simply how we read and what we read, but how and where we write. And for me, I try to use it as an editor to winnow, to tighten, to condense, to make a book more Spartan and then better. And I have found the Internet, the computer, to be the greatest facilitator of what I would call concise, good, readable prose. The reason it is so easy now, as compared to when we had a typewriter, to move paragraphs and to go back and re-edit and re-edit again, I probably will do and have done in my new book, Mercy, about Fenway Park. I probably have edited and re-edited the entire manuscript at least 6 to 7 times. That never would have happened with the typewriter simply because it was so physically difficult to do that then. The computer has made it easier. So I think that those are those, in shorthand, for me, what hasn't changed, how I write a book, what has changed, how I edit a book. And there's really no reason, in my view, for bad writing today because we have gifts that a writer simply didn't have even 10 to 20 years ago. We didn't know it then, but we do know it now.
Now, one of the things we discussed before we started recording was the fact that with this new technology, with the shift from published paper to e-books, there are more people writing who are using this technology,
right?
Not always to the best of the product.
No, you know, it's that's very true. Dorothy Parker of the Algonquin Club was once asked if she enjoyed having read, and she said, no, I enjoyed writing, rather. She said, no, I enjoy having writ, which beautifully delineated, I think, the difference between writing and the nobility of having written. And I think that there is a delineation lacking today between people who write and people who purport to write, by and large, in the blogosphere. I am not an enemy of the blogosphere. I respect and I Google. But I do think that writing, you know, on the blogosphere, on the Internet every day, having bad grammar, misusing words, having one typo after another, is not writing. I don't know what it's called, but it's not writing. Writing to me is exactly the process that I just described, and it's the process that you follow as well. And that is that you check your sources that have credibility. You don't take just one source, but you reaffirm that source. You make sure that you or someone else goes over your finished product time and time and time again so that you don't have commas that should be periods and vice versa, that you don't have prepositions dangling, that you don't have words misspelled. There's a term for that. It's called sloppy. And good writing isn't sloppy. And I think that future generations, a concern of mine that is great, because I teach college, including public speaking and presidential writing, and then other writing as well, is that students today do not appreciate the difference between the kind of writing worthy of the term and something that is put on paper, put on the Internet, but put in a such a rudimentary and inferior sort of way.
Your previous book, A Talk in the Park, was published by Potomac last year.
Yeah.
The current book comes out in May.
Right.
Do you set goals for yourself? Do you want to publish on a regular basis, or
well,
as the spirit moves you?
You know, and it's interesting because in 2009, Potomac also published Pull Up a Chair, the Vin Scully story. And this has been, Ron, a goal of mine for several years now, and that is I got tired of it. With every new book having this sort of auctioneer or prostitute, I wanted to develop a relationship with a firm that I respected, that I could call up, that I thought was authoritative, and that if I had an idea, I would know with whom to talk. I like that sort of old shoe relationship, and in that sense, it's worked out well. Why do I write so often? Because there's a lot to write about. Because I'm a workaholic, and I think probably on my tombstone it's going to have this phrase, anything to pay the bills. So I think that there are a variety of reasons. The Fenway book, of course, is easy because this is my team. There's never been a book about the great broadcasters from Hoey to Britt to Gowdy to Martin and Woods to Ned to Ken Coleman and more recently Hawk Harrelson. John Miller was a Red Sox broadcaster. Dick Stockton, Sean McDonough, today Joe Castiglione and Dave O'Brien and Don Orsillo and Jerry. I mean, it's an amazing litany. And as they say, you have one chance to honor a centennial. So I figured I'd better do it now. And also because, as I say, no one had told the story of Fenway Park through the calls and the lives of the people on radio and TV.
Now, one of the other things we also discussed briefly before we came on was how the role of the author has changed, how the author is called upon to do more in terms of promoting his book and getting it out.
Yeah.
Now, is that something you enjoy?
Well, I think there are two things. Number one, we were talking also about at least I have tried to become personally and physically involved as much as I can with every stage of the book. You know, the cover, but also the writing of the material on the back cover and in the inside cover, as well as literally even reading every page of the final proof, because you know, again, my name is on the cover and I want it to be as accurate and good as possible. The promotion is inevitable. And if a writer thinks, maybe if you're the late Stephen Ambrose or Tom Clancy or someone of that ilk, you can simply put a book out and hope because of your marquee and expect that it will sell. But for 99.9% of writers, as we know, you've got to get out there and sell and vend and merchandise. And if I wish to be pejorative, I would say to prostitute. But you've got to market aggressively your book. And I can't tell you the number of first book authors who have written a book of which they're proud, who then put it on the market, who sit back and expect it to sell, not knowing that you have, I would say conservatively, or liberally perhaps, in fact, you've got maybe 2 to 3 months after a book is released to really make an influence and an effort and have an effect and have that book sell. Because the publisher, if your book hasn't sold, guess what? They'll go on to another book, and you'll be left stranded by yourself. So I have felt and feel more so today that you have to get out and aggressively sell your book. That means book signings, but not book signings alone. It means as much radio or television as you can possibly get. I have told my publicist now, I think as long as I can recall, in terms of radio or television stations or newspapers, I said, I don't care what the question is. The answer is yes, I'll do it.
The publicist is from Potomac, or you have your own?
No, you know, I have invested. They have a publicist, and they do a fine job. But they can't be expected, no publishing press can, to focus 100% of their time on your book. They have other books in their catalog. I have one book that I am concerned about at that time. It's mine. And so basically what I've done is taken, you know, a couple thousand dollars, if you will, and invest it wisely in a publicist, a freelancer with whom I've worked. And it has worked out very well. And, you know, before a book is released, I know I'm going to be spending a lot of hours in my car driving to different ballparks and different cities, and then, you know, talking to people about a common love. Despite all the time and all the effort and all the distance that you might travel, which necessarily wears on you, here's something I love, and that is talking to people who love what I do. Whether it be at Cooperstown or whether it be, you know, at PNC Ballpark in Pittsburgh or Fenway or you name it, there's nothing better than talking to people about ball. I know you'd agree.
And you never know, one of these people might give you an idea for your next book.
Yes, I've always said that 90% of, you know, Woody Allen said that 90% of success is simply showing up. That, with that, I disagree. But I do know that 90% of any book for me is the idea. Once I've got the idea, the other 10% is simply sitting down day after day after day, writing, even days, and they do occur, when writing is the last thing on earth that you would rather do. But you keep at it. A book doesn't write itself, you do. And, you know, the older I've gotten, I've come more and more to the realization that, radio and television, doing them are fun. I loved writing presidential speeches. But, you know, books have something they don't have. They last. And that separates a book from an eBay or an e-book or whatever, you know, is the latest terminology. There is nothing like going into a bookstore, smelling the smell, grasping the ambience, embracing it with people that love bookstores as you do. And, you know, books have been around, I think, conservatively, what now, 2,000 years, a couple millennia? They've got a few years to go. And hopefully we do, too.
Now, you have a website. It's KurtSmithUSA.com.
Right.
Do you have something especially set aside for the new book?
I will. My you know, you talked about me being busy writing. And a victim of that has been my website, which is about 3 or 4 years out of kilter. That is about Rhonda Change. I've set aside a week in March, basically to literally from start to finish revamp my website. And, yes, there definitely will be a picture of the cover, pictures of Red Sox broadcasters, and there will be a special section devoted to the new book entitled Mercy. And as you know, the title is a celebration of Fenway Park Centennial, told through Red Sox radio and TV.
Kurt Smith, it's been a pleasure as always. Much luck with the book, and we look forward to reading it as soon as it comes out.
Always a pleasure, Ron, talking to you. What you've done on radio and podcasting and in print is the envy of anyone who writes, and my kudos for that.
And that was our conversation with Kurt Smith. For more information, visit his website, KurtSmithUSA.com. Remember to visit Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf Facebook page and click like to enter the monthly random drawing. The current Facebook friend book is Kurt Smith's A Talk in the Park, 9 decades of baseball tales from the broadcast booth. And that will about do it for another podcast edition of The Bookshelf. Our scheduled guest next week is Andy Strasberg, founder of Fantography.net and author of the new book, Baseball Fantography, A Celebration in Snapshots and Stories from the Fans. Visit the blog regularly for the latest baseball book news. Questions, comments? Send an email to Ron at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com. So long, everybody.